Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today is World AIDS Day, and while progress against HIV worldwide continues to see successes and setbacks, today we focus on Americans aging with HIV. According to the Center for Disease Control, nearly 50% of the Americans living with HIV are now 50 years of age or older. For those Americans who lived through the dark days of the epidemics in the 1980s, they've seen much. A ravaging of a generation, the loss of close friends, lovers, and social circles, the promise of antiretroviral drugs. Finally, in 1996, those promises came true. And as they age, they have all the physical and mental and cognitive effects of aging, along with HIV. My guest today has written about the stories of what he calls the AIDS generation in his book of the same name. Dr. Perry Halkitis is a professor of applied psychology, global public health, and medicine at NYU, where he specializes in HIV/AIDS biobehavioral research studies for gay men, with an emphasis on the mental health burdens they face. He also directs the Center for Health, Identity, Behavior, and Prevention Studies at the university. He'll be the guest of the Dennis R. Neal Equality Center this evening at 6:30 in commemoration of World AIDS Day, speaking about his book, The AIDS Generation, Stories of Survival and Resilience. Dr. Halkitis is my guest today. Perry Halkitis, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The CDC estimates that sometime in this coming year, about half of Americans living with HIV will be 50 years of age or older. 50 years of age, you've written, is a sort of a demarcation point. Why is that age important?
Well, 50 years old is generally accepted in literature as the beginning of, you know, middle to later adulthood. And it's the time in life when there are medical changes, psychological changes, social changes in people's lives. You know, psychological theory has documented this pattern of life for decades. So this is an incredibly important time in life, and as people prepare to retire, to prepare for the last 30 years of their life, even more complicated for people who are living with HIV, who are now facing older adulthood, complicated by all the demands of aging, the emotional demands, the physical demands, and also living and trying to manage HIV.
And that last part, living and managing HIV above age 50, we see accelerated rates of virtually all the things that affect the whole human population, but at an accelerated rate for people living with HIV. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely right. There is evidence that people who are older and living with HIV, who are aging with HIV, have higher rates of certain cancers, cardiovascular diseases, perhaps even neurocognitive deficits at much higher rates than the quote-unquote normal population. And what makes it complex is it's unclear why these manifestations are happening. Are they happening because of the HIV disease? Is it happening because of the medications? Is it happening because of the combination of the medication and the HIV disease? So disentangling those issues is critically important if we're to provide the best possible service to people who are aging with this disease.
And for those who have had HIV for a long time, perhaps lived even through the dark days in the 80s and 90s, that's also a heavy mental health issue, isn't it?
So that's a beautiful question, actually. And so
what I'm trying to phrase this as sensitive as I can, but if you've lost tons of friends in the 80s and 90s, you have the same disease and you're there. There's just survivor's guilt, among other things.
It's such a complicated reality, and it's, I think, one of the inspirations for me in writing this book, The AIDS Generation, was to tell the story of a set of individuals who lived through all of that and now find themselves in middle age. And the idea first came to me about 10 years ago when it became clear that these medications that had come into place in 1996 were going to work, right? That people could live normal life expectancies. And so I wondered what this would mean for individuals who in the 80s and early 90s were expecting to die. You know, people always thought, I write about the myth of two in the book, the idea that you would be dead in 2 years, saw much death around them, lost their social circles, some lost their financial stability, and now are at or around 50 years old. It's a big, like, question mark. It became a big question mark over my head. How does one prepare to enter these later stages of life after a lifetime of sort of being in the later stages of life, of preparing to die, and now finding oneself in later stages of life when death is pretty much going to happen at 80 years old or 70 years old, right? So this was really what the inspiration was, to try to tell these stories and to try to like tease apart how these individuals were making sense of this point of their lives.
What was your, I'm sure you saw a huge gamut of reactions to that. Give us a sense of the spectrum.
So you have on one end of the spectrum the individuals who, you know, even in the late 80s, despite the odds being against them, continue to go on with their lives. They continue to go on with their careers. They go on with relationships. They find themselves at 50 or 55 years old, very stable in terms of all the other aspects of their lives. You know, they have a job, they have a career, they have homes. That's one reality. The other reality are the individuals who basically gave up everything. They gave up their careers. They gave up their homes. They gave up their relationships. They were doing everything. They gave up their money. They were preparing to die and now find themselves at 50, 49, 52, without a job, without very much money, unable to enter the workforce again because they can work, but who's going to hire them after being out of the workforce for so many years? And so those are the two extremes, and then there's everything in between. What I can say is common, however, about all of the men who I spoke to in this book is the sense of feeling for a very long time like they were in it alone. And what's happened throughout this country over the last 2 years is there's been an increasing amount of dialogue around aging with HIV, and people who are long-term survivors have found each other, are supporting each other. And what I see and how I experience this is they've come together in a way that people came together in the 80s to fight the epidemic.
Mm. Sounds like they're building whole new social circles then.
They're totally building whole new social circles. One of the interesting things in the interviews that came out was this issue, again, of being lonely, of not having a place to go. So what one of the men said to me, well, I don't need a safer sex workshop, and I'm 55 years old. I don't want to go to bars and clubs. Where do I go to meet my peers? Where do I go to meet my, you know, my contemporaries? Where do we come together to be in a space just to be with each other? And there was a lot of that. One man said that. There was a theme that occurred again and again. And I pushed back during the interviews and said, well, in the 80s when we had nothing, we built everything. We built ACT UP. We built GMHC. We built all of the structures that exist in this country. It's time for us to build, but build something new. And that's exactly what's happening. And you see it in New York. You see it in San Francisco. It's going to spring up all over the country because by 2015, 50% are ages 50 and older. By 2020, 70% are ages 50 and older.
Hmm. Well, that also sounds like that if that is the statistic, that says that we're certainly cutting down on infections in the United States where it's pretty low at this point.
Well, we are under the best circumstances allowing an individual who becomes infected today and gets access to care and goes on treatment to have a normal life expectancy. A 20-year-old today who becomes infected could have a normal life expectancy. Are we reducing infections? We have 50,000 new infections each year in this country. Mm. You know, we should have no infections. That'll be, you know, getting to zero is a tagline that's being used a lot right now. And in my home state, in New York City, our governor, Andrew Cuomo, has called for an end of AIDS by 2020. He would like to reduce the infections. He would like people who are living with HIV to be on medication, living healthy lives. And the idea is if people who are positive take their medications, live healthy lives, and people who are negative use different kinds of procedures to protect themselves, including condoms, but something that's in the news a lot now, PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, we may be able with these biomedical technologies to get there.
Hmm. That sounds great. I mean, but still 50,000 new infections a year.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And is that just sort of a lessening? I think there's a tendency to think of HIV infection the same way you think of a chronic disease like diabetes or asthma. Is that informing that infection rate?
Perhaps, although the literature hasn't really, I think, supported that.
I think there have been news reports that have always referred to that, and I just wonder how true that is medically evidence-wise.
And so I'll respond to that in two ways. So this idea of HIV optimism, like people think that HIV is not a big deal anymore. I have a study where I'm following 650 young men from ages 18 on. They're now 22 to 23. The notion that younger men, younger gay men, don't care about HIV or are not afraid of it is nonsense. nonsense, right? And this is a mythology that needs to be debunked. They are afraid of HIV. They do not want to become positive. So the HIV optimism thing is a little problematic in my mind. I see it somewhat differently. So if we think about these 50,000 new infections, where do we see these infections? Some 62% is in gay men, primarily black and Hispanic gay men. Where else do we see the epidemic? We see it primarily in populations that are poor, that have limited access. So the work that I do is informed by this idea of what I call syndemics theory, which basically argues that you see health problems, and it could be HIV, it could be cigarette smoking, it could be mental health, it could be obesity.
So the sin is sin in syndemics, right?
Right. That's a syndemic. These health problems co-occur and are fueled by structural inequalities, by social conditions, by marginalization, by burdens that people experience that make them place their lives at risk. And as a result, may engage in behaviors that ultimately compromise their well-being. And so what's the solution? One would argue, well, I think the solution is we continue to have medical technologies that are effective, like PrEP and like HIV treatments. We continue to do our behavioral interventions, which we've done for 30 years. We spend millions and millions of dollars on, right? Continue to use condoms, have safer sex practices, but also try to equalize the playing field for people so that people do not feel marginalized and discriminated against. And, you know, I wrote an op-ed a few years ago that basically said, I believe that marriage equality is ultimately is going to have a beneficial effect on the health of gay men.
I was struck by something you said earlier in our conversation. You said, you know, in the last 2 years, we've started really thinking about developing these new social circles for aging with HIV. And if you aren't going to clubs and, you know, the old traditional places where men met people for social interactions, then there needs to be new places. But that stigma is still a part of the general population, but that it seems to be diminishing now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole thing, is with more acceptance of gay marriage, every aspect of gay culture. I mean, that's the last big taboo of gay culture, is for the mainstream population.
I think you use the most important word, stigma.
Yeah.
And I think when you destigmatize something, I wrote in an editorial, I don't know, maybe sometime last year, that, you know, I think about a young child born with a year that New York State enacted marriage equality, which I think is actually 2 or 3 years ago at this point. And I think about that young man or woman's life and the ability to grow up in a society where who he or she loves is legitimized. That's a different life experience than mine, you know, a 51-year-old man who is amazed that he's actually married and never thought that this would be a possibility for him, right? So think about what that feels like emotionally, growing up in a society that accepts you. Well, you don't need to perhaps then turn to drugs and alcohol and other behaviors to diminish those bad feelings created by society. And so as a result, you are a healthier human being.
Mm. My guest today is Perry Halkidis, a professor of applied psychology, global public health and medicine at NYU, and he is the author of several books, but his most recent is titled The AIDS Generation, Stories of Survival and Resistance. It's published by Oxford University Press, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa on World AIDS Day. Now, your book, The AIDS Generation, you describe the stories of these people who have been living with HIV through the dark 80s and early 90s, when mortality was so high. You've referred to them as the bravest generation.
Right.
I like that term. Why the bravest generation?
Yeah, so it was interesting. I went back and forth with that. That's the end of the first sentences in the first paragraph of the book. Because I think that what I wanted to do was to bring attention to what we had accomplished together, right? And the pain, the horrors that we had lived through, and that we had come out of that stronger, right? And I think, you know, Tom Brokaw told us about the greatest generation, right? And absolutely, you know, I can't even imagine of being a soldier in World War II. But our reality as young people, and let me be clear, when I talk about the AIDS generation, I refer to positive and negative people, men and women, everybody, my generation that had to live through this disease, infected or not infected.
Right. And
we were all affected.
You know,
right?
I mean, everybody who lived through that decade of the 80s, whether you were hetero or gay or whatever, it was like this dark cloud hanging over it. There was tons of misinformation, tons of no information, and, you know, people were dying left and right. And there was just no acknowledgement that this was an issue.
Right. It's, you know, if
from the government.
Absolutely.
Like, for
many, many years. You know, generational theory would argue, what is a generation? Is it really a group of people that are cut off by dates? Not really. It's a group of people who are defined by an experience. And the AIDS generation, you know, those of us who came of age in the late 70s, 80s, early 90s, all lived through that experience. We're brave because we didn't just lie back and, you know, and say we're going to let this disease overrun us. We banded together and we fought, you know, as it's been beautifully depicted in How to Survive a Plague, David France's film, and other accounts also. We came together and we were very, very brave. You know, we did things that I think actually have transformed how we think about public health nowadays.
Now, and I think what you're sort of referring to with this as people with HIV age is coming up with a new set of bravery to find these new connections in a positive way for, you know, healthy social relationships.
Absolutely. I will say to you that, you know, it starts small. So the 15 men who I interviewed for my book are the beginnings and they've started to meet, they formed a circle, they socialized together, and that circle has expanded. And that circle then became an event at Gay Men's Health Crisis. And there's events in San Francisco. Yes. So it's about banding together, saying, this is what we need. Pay attention. This is what we need, AIDS service organizations, community-based organizations, doctors. Listen to us and provide us the services that we need. So, it's sort of like, in some ways, I hate to use this expression, but I'm going to, like, coming out of the closet again, right, for some of these men and women, you know, and banding together and saying, look, we are a significant portion of this population that has to be attended to.
So what are the needs right now?
Yeah. So there are many needs. I want to let me frame it also slightly differently and say that with aging come complications, but there are also amazing stories of bravery and resilience and power that we can tap into to inform how we deliver these services, right? So these individuals did something right for 30 years to survive, right? And what I would argue they did is that they attended to their physical well-being, their social well-being, and their emotional well-being altogether, right? And sort of packaged it in a way to let them survive. So what do we need to do? So we need to understand really, from a medical perspective, we really need to understand. Let me step back and say, in 30 years, when there will continue to be another generation that's aging with HIV, we will know a lot more. This is the first generation, right? So in some ways, we're going to learn here. But it's critical that we figure out what the physical complications are for the aging body on these medications that was bombarded by a virus for a very long time. Based on that, then to determine what are the appropriate kind of services that doctors can provide. So, for example, I know many physicians who are HIV physicians who provide their patients, even if they don't have high blood pressure, even if they don't have high levels of cholesterol, medications to protect against the development of that. What you might prescribe to a 65-year-old, they're prescribing to a 45-year-old as a preventive approach. So there's that whole physical place. Two, the social thing we've talked about, which is like providing a space and enabling people who are aging with HIV to come together. Our generation, the AIDS generation, the baby boomers, the Xers, are having very different demands of what we want in terms of service delivery. We don't want to sit in a room and play cards, right? Right. That might have been fine for the generation before us, but we have very different expectations. So right. I think there's a whole struggle in this country overall on what kind of socialization and social venues we provide to baby boomers, Xers, as they're getting older.
Well, I think that's brings up a great point, because a lot of our aging facilities are sort of built on that model of sit around, play cards, play shuffleboard, play the Wii.
That's right. Mahjong. Let's play Mahjong. That's what we want to do. And we know that's not really where I, you know, and certainly as a 51-year-old, not where my head's at by any means.
Should we think of this generation living with HIV as sort of you're accelerating the aging process of needing those sorts of services earlier in life?
I believe so. I mean, I think that, you know, there is an acceleration of health complications. There is maybe an acceleration of emotional complications. You know, I believe that mental health providers have played a huge role in the epidemic from the very beginning. When there were no medications, people had their social workers or their therapists. Engaging and providing those kind of supports to people as they're getting older who are struggling now with, by the way, a new set of deaths, right? Because all of a sudden their cohort of friends is older and they're going to slowly die off. So emotional support is going to be critically important in getting this generation.
Let's talk about discrimination in medical treatment. It may not be a big issue in, say, the West Coast and the East Coast, but here in the middle of the country, I've heard horror stories of men with very treatable cancers not being able to get the proper treatment in time to start the regimen in time, and just a shortage of doctors, like oncologists who just don't want to treat HIV positive men.
So
or
the,
women.
Right. You know, HIV, unfortunately, in this country, in many people's minds, is still tied to homosexuality, right? And so for many people, there's a lot of, judgment around the disease. Nonetheless, the Institute of Medicine published a report in 2010 that showed that lesbian, gay, bisexual individuals experience health disparities at very high rates, right? And that there are healthcare providers who are not equipped at all to provide those services. I will say, I don't think it's a perfect situation in New York and San Francisco either, right? So I think that, I hear stories. One of the manifestations of HIV in gay men is anal cancer. Exposure to certain strains of HPV can lead to anal cancer. We have doctors in New York City who are not testing their patients, who are, very well-respected HIV doctors, who are not having conversations with their patients about this. And one of my closest friends, Stephen Goldstone, who is a world-renowned for the work he does around anal cancer, is horrified at the number of cases he's able to detect of cancer on a daily basis. So what do we need to do? We not only need to educate people in the middle of the country, we need to educate providers all over the country. The Cuomo plan in New York State around HIV eradication, it has as a big, big cornerstone educating healthcare providers around the issues of HIV. We need to do the same thing with lesbian, gay, bisexual health issues.
My guest today is Dr. Perry Alkitis, a professor of applied psychology, a global public health and medicine at NYU. He's the author of The AIDS Generation, Stories of Survival and Resistance. He'll be participating in a lecture tonight at the Equality Center at 6:30, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, since this is World AIDS Day, we've been talking about the situation here in the United States. Is there any better news on the world front as far as combating HIV infection around the world? Or are there still a lot of really Africa, for example, Asia?
It's Southeast a mixed Asia. Bag. Certainly, we have made a dent in the African epidemic. We are seeing some good results in countries like South Africa. Providing medications to people who need them has really helped to control the situation there. But at the same time, you see situations like we're seeing in Greece, which, had this horrible economic downturn, 3 or 4 years ago, and drug use and HIV rates have gone through the roof. So it's really generally, we're in a much better place than we were 33 years ago. Nobody would argue against that. However, it's an epidemic that continues to manifest in very strange ways, in different circumstances, and it requires ongoing vigilance.
Earlier, you talked about PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis. Why don't you explain what that is exactly? Because it's a mix of the traditional HIV prevention methods, use of condoms and counseling and things like that, but also use of drugs ahead of infection.
Right. And so 2 years ago, there have been a series of trials over the course of the last few years. And 2 years ago, the Food and Drug Administration approved the use of one medication named Truvada, which is an HIV medication. People who are HIV positive take it to treat their HIV. Approved it for the use of HIV prevention because what the trials showed is that individuals who take Truvada on a daily basis and consistently take it are able to deter infection with HIV because the medication provides protection against HIV. So this is called pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP. It is an approach that's really being pushed throughout the country as a way of eliminating HIV. Interestingly, a study done in 2011 to 2013 found that most of the PrEP prescriptions were written for women in the South, which I think is an interesting phenomenon.
Interesting.
Very, very interesting. I think that's changing as education is getting out there about it. But PrEP is a powerful, powerful, powerful tool that comes with its own limitations, which is you have to take a pill every day. right? And we know how difficult it is for people to do any behavior every single day. HIV-positive people can't take their medications every single day. So there are different tests going on right now to test intermittent PrEP, which is occasional use of the medication, injectables that would require maybe three times a year or twice a year. But there's a lot of hope in this, as in the absence of a cure and in the absence of a vaccine, PrEP is a really powerful tool.
That was my next question. What are we hearing about a vaccine?
Still in the works. You know, we don't have a vaccine. You know, the vaccine trials, you know, from several years ago yielded very, very mixed results. You know, there are trials going on now. HIV is a tricky little virus, and it's really hard. You know, it has so many subtypes, and it's very difficult to try to find out the most effective vaccine. You know, ultimately, how will we rid this world of HIV? A vaccine, absolutely, is the answer. But I think we're way off still.
Yeah, I know you're not a virologist, but what makes this retrovirus so difficult? I was reading about malaria recently, and malaria is a crazy disease where, it's in your liver and it's undetectable and it pops out every so often. Is it the same sort of thing?
Where very similar.
It has an ability to hide itself?
It does. And in fact, you know, we test HIV-positive people for the virus in their blood. And we say, oh, somebody's undetectable. That's a great sign. But we don't know where the virus is hiding in the brain and what have you. The other thing is that this virus mutates. And so you see many, 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 many subtypes. And the problem is that we have a situation where not only do we have a mutated virus because it naturally mutates, but we have a mutated virus that has mutated because of the medications people have been taking. So just as we have penicillin resistance now and we have to turn to other medications, we have to be very careful in how we use these medications to prevent further resistance to for the HIV virus to be fought off.
Now, you're going to be speaking tonight at the Equality Center, which is one of those places you were talking about where it's not a club or a bar.
Right.
It's sort of this healthy atmosphere sort of place for people to meet one another. Is that the next goal, is set up more places like this around the country?
So there are LGBT centers around the country. There's something special about your Equality Center here. It's a pretty remarkable place. This is my second visit to Tulsa in the last few months. I was remarkably impressed. But that's the kind of space you want. You want a space where people can come and be with each other, where they can socialize with each other. Where this is not denying that people can want to go to bars and clubs, but they don't want to go to bars and clubs every single night. So creating this safe space where there are some workshops, where there are some groups, but where there are also just couches, and there's a gift shop, right? You know, that's a huge plus, right? That says something about creating a space that's safe and comfortable for people to come to. I saw it last night. You know, there was a beautiful lighting ceremony that took place there. There was so many people there, so happy to take part in it. That creates a camaraderie that ultimately lifts a whole community and improves its health.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with your work. The name of the new book is The AIDS Generation, Stories of Survival and Resistance. Perry Halkitis, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Perry Halkitis is a professor of applied psychology, global public health, and medicine at NYU. He's the author of the book, The AIDS Generation, Stories of Survival and Resilience. It's published by Oxford University Press. He'll be a special guest of the Dennis R. Neal Equality Center this evening at 6:30, speaking in commemoration of World AIDS Day. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.